Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For over 20 years, Columbia Riverkeeper has been a major voice in protecting the mighty Columbia River. In that time, Riverkeeper has worked on many fronts to enforce environmental laws to stop illegal pollution, protect salmon habitat, and challenge harmful fossil fuel terminals. Their legal work has made a significant difference, but much of the change they have inspired comes from helping communities organize and stand together for something they believe in. This summer, Columbia Riverkeeper will change leadership as longtime Executive Director Britt VandenHeuvel departs and current Legal and Program Director Lauren Goldberg takes over the helm. Today we talk with Lauren about the organization's plans to continue to successfully protect, restore, and care for our Columbia River. Lauren, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you so much for having me, Barbara. I'm so excited to be on today.
Well, a lot of people are excited about this new position that you've taken, so I want to congratulate you that you're going to be the new Executive Director of Columbia Riverkeeper. So let's start by talking about what does that mean, both for you and for the organization?
Well, it's a huge honor, and I'm really humbled that our board of directors and our staff have asked me to take on the role of executive director. Columbia Riverkeeper is a nonprofit that works across the Pacific Northwest. Our mission is to protect and restore the Columbia River from the headwaters to the Pacific Ocean. And over the last 20 years, we've racked up incredible victories for clean water and our climate, working in solidarity with tribal nations and with communities up and down the Columbia. And for me, at the center of all this is just such an incredible love for the Columbia and for the people that I get to work with. And so for the organization, after I've actually been hanging around here for about 17 years, I started off as a law clerk and then became a staff attorney after law school. And for the last almost 7 years, I've been the legal and program director. And for our board and our staff and our members to so warmly embrace me as an executive director is just, it's really a lifetime honor and highlight.
Well, one of the biggest challenges, it would seem to me, is that Columbia Riverkeeper covers so many issues. I was just thinking about the percentage of issues that I cover on this show. And Columbia Riverkeeper, with maybe the exception of food security, covers everything else. So how do you balance all of that? And do you feel that you have expertise in all these areas, or do you have to delegate some of that to the people who have more expertise?
That is the greatest challenge that we face at Columbia Riverkeeper. And, you know, folks will ask me, what's the hardest part about your job? And it's saying no. What we have found over our successful history is what's really key is to dig deep on the issues that we take on and not try to take on everything, to recognize that there are incredible community groups, nonprofits, you know, local governments, tribal governments that are working also to protect our climate and clean water and many of the issues impacting the Columbia Basin. And where our secret sauce is marrying legal advocacy, grassroots community organizing, and really creative communications, and then digging into our five core program areas. And it's sometimes, unfortunately, having to say no in order to make sure that we see through the commitments we have made to communities, whether it's to stop a coal export terminal, to sue a polluter that's dumping toxic pollution in the Columbia, or to taking the long, hard road to ensure the federal government is held accountable for cleanup of the most contaminated site in the Western Hemisphere, the Hanford nuclear site.
Which makes me think of many times I've talked to Dan Sears about many things, and we had been having a number of conversations, I guess at that point, about methanol, about before that, about the oil by rail terminal that was proposed for Vancouver, Washington, and about LNG in Jordan Cove. And then came Hanford, and I made some comment about how much that keeps me up at night. And Dan said, that's the ultimate thing that keeps him up at night. So, and I've also talked to you about Hanford in the last few months. So why does that keep you up at night so much?
Well, Hanford's a ticking time bomb. We have, you know, the legacy of World War II and the Cold War right along the Columbia River. And there are underground tanks at Hanford that contain some of the world's most toxic and radioactive waste that are actively leaking into the soil and groundwater so close to the Columbia River. And it is without a doubt, you know, the most complicated toxic cleanup site in the country. It is in an area of the Columbia that couldn't be more magnificent and beautiful. It is in the sacred ancestral homelands of multiple tribal nations and bands. And it's an area where, unless people across the Pacific Northwest understand its significance in terms of its threat and the moral obligation that everyone living, not just in the Northwest, but in our country has to see this site cleaned up, that it is a reason that, you know, many of us, both on Columbia River Keeper staff and beyond, you know, keeps us up at night. How do we ensure that the government has the budget it needs, the oversight it needs, and the ambitious timeline that's required to protect the Columbia River and all people that depend on not only the Columbia, but, you know, just the area for whether they're working out in the site or living downstream?
Well, I think for almost as long as I've been doing radio, I've been dealing with Hanford. In fact, my very first couple radio documentaries I did were about Hanford. And I remember going out there at a time when they were still promoting it as it was going to be the federal repository for high-level waste. And they were planning on putting it inside this mountain, basically, and they gave me a little tour. My favorite thing was they gave me this black marble, because they're also talking about vitrification, which would be turning the waste into glass. And this was an example of what they were going to do with all that waste, was this little black marble, which was fortunately not radioactive. But when I went back a number of years later and was dealing more with the Hanford Reach and looking at issues about dams, the whole mission at Hanford had changed to cleanup. However, that was 20 years ago. So I'm wondering how you feel about this timeline that just seems to drag on.
It is a multi-generational cleanup period, and it requires that we have really deep engagement from all of our members of Congress, from state representatives, governors, mayors, you name it. And where public interest organizations come in, like Columbia Riverkeeper and our members, is to keep this issue front and center, to keep it fresh and interesting, because it is. You know, if you go out to the Hanford site and you dip your toes in the water and experience just the incredible natural beauty, if you listen to stories of people who grew up in the area, if you talk to, you know, members of Yakima Nation who describe the beyond words, the significance of the site for tribal members and tribal nations, it really hits home the significance of continuing the long-running commitment of organizations like Columbia Riverkeeper to seeing through the cleanup until it's over. And that's not going to happen in my lifetime.
Well, specifically, what is Columbia Riverkeeper doing as its part to speed up the keep the cleanup going?
Absolutely. For many years, we have advocated for Hanford cleanup. It's been an issue that we've kept front and center in many of the downstream and upstream communities that we work in. And so the way that we've done that has been on multiple levels. So one is legal and policy advocacy. We dig deep looking at how the government is proposing to undertake cleanup actions, what they're planning to delay, what's their budget that they're asking for. And then we make a point of engaging in the open public processes that the government puts out there for public interest organizations and members of the public to weigh in on. We have at times had to, you know, sue the government related to Hanford cleanup. We have worked in solidarity for many years with tribal nations, ensuring that the Hanford site, which is, you know, roughly the size of, you know, LA, it's a massive, massive site along the banks of the Columbia River, that it does not become the national nuclear waste repository. And we've been very successful in working with many incredible public interest advocacy groups and tribal nations and ensuring that that is not the future for the Hanford site. We work closely with tribal nations in increasing awareness of the significance of Hanford and the Columbia River to tribal people and governments. And we work in, whether it's in schools or community events, and making sure Hanford stays on the public radar.
There's Riverkeeper groups all around the country. In fact, there's several others in Oregon besides Columbia Riverkeeper. And I was just thinking, as you were talking about Hanford, I'm just wondering, is there any other Riverkeeper group that has quite as complex an array of issues to deal with as Columbia Riverkeeper has?
Well, Columbia Riverkeeper is part of the International Waterkeeper Alliance. So we all have our own boards of directors or our nonprofit structures, but we share this common bond and interest around fighting for clean water. And the groups across the globe have tremendous challenges that they face. I do not think we are alone in the breadth of issues and challenges that we tackle along the Columbia. You know, that said, it's true, you know, in our mission, when we were first set up 21 years ago and brought together by former Congresswoman Elizabeth First, Executive Director of the Umatilla Tribe, Don Sampson, and others, the decision to bring together multiple groups to protect the Columbia River Basin, an area the size of France, it was no small undertaking, to say the least, and it will be. It's every day myself, my colleagues at Columbia Riverkeeper come to work and roll up our sleeves and try to do right by this incredible river and the people that depend on it.
Well, I was thinking about somebody I talked to a number of years ago who was part of a watershed council who was talking about how watershed councils bring together the most incredible diversity of different voices and people from different backgrounds and different communities. And so then I'm thinking, well, Columbia River Basin is much bigger than just its many watersheds, actually. So it seems like it's a watershed council on steroids. So I want to talk about the diversity of people that you have contact with and that you're supporting and the diversity of issues that come because of such a large river basin.
That, for me, on a personal level, is one of the most gratifying things about working at Columbia Riverkeeper for so many years is the diversity of the people and the communities that we bring together and the thread that runs through all of those individuals who might come from incredibly different backgrounds, whether, have different, very different jobs and quite frankly, live in very different areas. The Tri-Cities is quite a different place to live and grow up than Portland or Astoria. And what I find so gratifying is to experience this thread that runs through everyone, where there's this shared common love and bond over protecting a resource like no other, the Columbia. And what I've noticed in our campaign, so one of the examples, the stories that really stands out for me, for many, many years, we worked with community members and tribal nations to fight massive liquefied natural gas, LNG terminals proposed in the Columbia River estuary, proposed in literally some of the most important salmon habitat on Earth. And along with each of those LNG terminals, which were, in the neighborhood of $6+ billion terminals, along with them came hundreds of miles of frack gas pipeline that would have run from Canada into the Columbia River estuary. And the real upside of gas pipelines is the fossil fuel company looks at a map and they throw them on the map wherever it fits best, which means that it brings together people from all different backgrounds and different communities. And then folks are able to come together. And that was ultimately our strength, what was our diversity in those fights. And it was just so beautiful to be in these meetings with, farmers, teachers, local business owners, corporate mucky mucks who were there to say, this is not what we want for our community. This is not what we need for our climate. And I don't want this on my property. This is dangerous. So it's definitely been one of the most gratifying things working at Columbia Riverkeeper, hands down.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBRU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. Today, we're talking with Columbia Riverkeeper's about-to-be new executive director, Lauren Goldberg, about the organization's plans to continue to successfully protect, restore, and care for our Columbia River. Does Columbia Riverkeeper go into Canada as well, or do they have their own organization?
Our work is not extensively in Canada, but we, depending often our campaigns, our fossil fuel campaigns have led us to work with folks in Canada through coalition efforts because, the reality is these massive fossil fuel proposals that have landed along the Columbia, proposed to land along the Columbia, much of that, whether it's, you know, gas or oil, is coming from Canada.
In fact, Jordan Cove down in Southern Oregon, that was going to be frack gas from Canada, most likely, even though they claimed it was going to be coming from Colorado, but people knew better. It does seem like the international boundary doesn't mean very much to rivers, salmon, or in many ways to people. I'm thinking about all the other areas now that you're dealing with, and one of the ones that's coming up soon has to do with removing the four Snake River dams. So there's a lot of dams in the Columbia River, and I wonder what Columbia Riverkeeper has done about the existing dams, and then we can talk more about what is happening, what's pretty exciting about with the Snake River dams.
Dams along the Columbia and Snake Rivers have devastated salmon and steelhead populations. There's not scientific debate about that. That's well established. And for many years, Columbia Riverkeeper has been part of the long-running Endangered Species Act litigation, which has been one of the most powerful tools to affect change at the existing dams along the Columbia and Snake Rivers, the federal dams, and how they operate and how their operations impact salmon. In recent years, we shifted our attention to some creative legal strategies, which was has been a real highlight for me, looking at what are other ways beyond the very powerful tool of the Endangered Species Act, but what are other ways that we can affect change beyond that? Because we do hit walls at times. That is the reality of that statute. So we have used the Clean Water Act. We sued the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers multiple times, as well as the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, for illegally discharging toxic oil pollution and other pollution into the Columbia River for decades in violation of the Federal Clean Water Act. And that litigation, we were so proud, it immediately led to settlement and really strong, ultimately court-ordered commitments from the federal government to follow the law. But what's also intriguing is that along with those lawsuits came this very powerful legal tool known as 401 certification. Not many folks had heard of it until the Trump administration, when they attempted to gut state and tribal government's power under that creative legal tool.
So what is the 401 certification?
Well, it gives states and tribal governments the power to impact pollution from federally permitted projects, whether it's a, natural gas or oil pipeline, an industrial facility, an LNG terminal, you name it. And the power of 401 can't be overstated. It's also a veto power. It's the state's ability and tribal government's ability to say, no, this is too much pollution. This is too much harm to whether it's a river, Puget Sound, et cetera. And so with our litigation against the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation, we were able to trigger this latent legal tool that we are now on the cusp of finally seeing really important state action that can influence how the dams are operated and go even further than the accomplishments that have come out of many years of Endangered Species Act litigation. So that was a lot of legal gibberish. We are also deep in communities doing grassroots community organizing to build power, both from businesses, from community groups, and from, your average person walking down the street, to advocate for dam removal. We need the four lower Snake River dams out. They were the dams that were built most recently in the basin, and they are the ones that have scientists have identified as being the most harmful to salmon steelhead runs that are on the brink of extinction. And so we've been very fortunate to be a part of an incredible movement led by tribal governments, a number of incredible public interest advocacy organizations here in Oregon and Washington, Idaho, and throughout the country that have come together. And not only to save Columbia River salmon and steelhead, Snake River salmon and steelhead, but to protect Orca. And so it's really, it's a campaign that touches on so many facets of what it means to be a human living in the Pacific Northwest, and how we in the year 2020 grapple with the legacy of hydropower development and control of the Columbia and Snake Rivers, and what the future we will leave our children, and whether they will have the powerful experience of catching a salmon steelhead or seeing an orca.
So what is the connection between the orca and the Snake River salmon?
Orca are very dependent on them as a food source. Orca also feed right, near the mouth of the Columbia River. So it's this, you know, it is, when you look at a map or if you're on a road trip, it is mind-blowing to think about these connections, but they are so deep and integral. What happens in one part of the basin has this ripple effect across the entire Northwest.
Well, I've noticed once the orcas came into the Remove the Snake River Dam campaign, it really ratcheted up a whole other level. I want to talk about what that felt like and who you saw coming on board once the connection between how the orcas are really being endangered in the Salish Sea and the fact that the salmon are being endangered because of the Snake River dams.
People love orcas. You know, I don't know for your listeners how many folks have had the chance to watch documentaries like Dam to Extinction, or, you know, experience viewing, or, you know, just closing your eyes while you're staring at the water and imagining what's happening underneath. It changed the level, the power of the campaign in a way that just can't be overstated. The urgency, you know, the urgency has never been greater to remove the four lower Snake River dams. And just today, Governor Inslee and Senator Murray issued a much anticipated report looking at what it would mean to remove the four lower Snake River dams, what it would mean for salmon, what it would cost. And, you know, the punchline is, you know, these dams need to come out to save, you know, the iconic salmon and steelhead of the Northwest. And we've never had more power and momentum than we do right now to make it happen.
So Governor Inslee and Senator Murray are finally coming out for breaching the dams?
They have not come out with that official position. They've opened they've released a report, and there's a comment period until July 11th. And after the tribal nations, the public have the opportunity to weigh in, they will make their final recommendation.
Well, this latest campaign seems to have been triggered a while back by a congressman in Idaho who really opened up the dialogue. I want to talk about him and what role he had in getting a broader segment of politicians to take this seriously.
Yeah, it's critical to realize that the movement to remove the four lower Snake River dams, the values around saving what defines for so many what makes the Pacific Northwest the Pacific Northwest, it is an issue that crosses the political aisle. It is an issue that brings in folks that might not see eye to eye on other issues. And when Representative Simpson stepped forward and took a bold position for any legislator, let alone a Republican, it again was another huge moment of reset that happened around this long-running debate on the future of the Lower Snake River dams.
Now, I know that some salmon advocates were feeling like his position didn't really go far enough, but it seemed like it opened up a dialogue. And I'm curious about what kind of dialogue you're having at your end with Columbia Riverkeeper, talking to this kind of conservative Republican congressman who seemed to me was trying to figure out how to talk to you guys.
Yeah, it's at Columbia Riverkeeper, we have we've definitely looked at the campaign to remove the four lower Snake River dams as one that, you know, first and foremost has to be led by tribal governments. And it has been, and it was very much tribes working with members of Congress, along with public interest advocacy groups like Columbia Riverkeeper, that created the space for this really kind of new and bold thinking around the energy future of the Pacific Northwest, as well as the fishing future of the Pacific Northwest. Whether the Columbia and the Snake Rivers will be rivers we stare at and, you know, remember old songs and stories of how they once teemed with salmon and steelhead, or whether, you know, for generations to come, everyone can experience the thrill of catching a wild salmon.
This is something that I see that Columbia Riverkeeper is pushing on a whole new level. And I'm very grateful for the work that you've done on this issue. Where do you think you're going to go from now?
Well, the campaign to, you know, save Snake River salmon, orca, you know, from extinction is far from over. Time and again at Columbia Riverkeeper, to protect the Columbia, to work deeply in community, these are not 1 year, 2 year, 3 year campaigns. These are, you know, often multi-decade efforts. And we saw that with, and it's still ongoing with the effort to transform the Columbia River into the nation's fossil fuel highway with coal, oil, frack gas exports. It, you know, we weren't able to stop them overnight, but with many years of grit and perseverance, together working in solidarity with tribal nations, communities, we were able to do it. And that's the case as well with the campaign trip, you know, save salmon from extinction, remove the four lower Snake River dams. It's going to take many more years of hard work. That said, we're at a critical political moment right now in history in terms of whether our elected officials will listen to their, what we hope is a very strong moral compass on the need to stop extinction and to stand by the treaties the United States government signed with multiple tribal governments and protect Snake River steelhead and salmon.
I was wondering, what's the position of your other senator in Washington, Maria Cantwell? Is she on board with this?
To date, Maria Cantwell has not come out in support of Far Lower Snake River Dam removal.
But do you think there's enough political momentum on the part of the politicians in Washington State and Oregon? I mean, I know that Kate Brown came out for breaching the dam several years ago, so there's seems to be more momentum on the Oregon side of the river. But do you see that there's a growing movement amongst politicos in Washington to also come on board?
Absolutely. And I think the willingness of Governor Inslee and Senator Murray to come together and, you know, roll up their sleeves and really take the hardest look that they ever have at Snake River Dam removal is testament to that.
And it's testament to all the work that Columbia Riverkeeper has been doing. So again, congratulations on all of that.
Well, in many tribal governments and many of our partners, it's really been a true team effort.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFG up here from KODX LP FM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Columbia Riverkeeper's new executive director, or about to be new executive director, Lauren Goldberg, about the organization's plans to continue to successfully protect, restore, and care for the Columbia River. Well, you mentioned the struggle to stop the Columbia River from becoming a superhighway for the fossil fuel industry. Let's talk a little bit about the successes that you have reaped and what the challenges still are in that department.
Well, in recent decades, the fossil fuel industry targeted the Columbia River, and particularly the Columbia River estuary, for some of the nation's and the world's largest fossil fuel export terminals from coal, oil, frack gas. So Columbia Riverkeeper and our members have been at the center of incredible collective campaigns to stop what would have really undermined not only the Pacific Northwest climate goals and actions, but the entire countries. And I'm so proud of all that people, the power of people coming together to stop these terminals and pipelines. And when you take a step back and look at, you know, bird's eye view, what does that actually mean on the ground? We've been part of campaigns that have stopped 15
fossil fuel infrastructure projects, from, you know, massive liquefied natural gas terminals in the Columbia River estuary, what would have been the nation's largest coal export terminal in Longview, Washington, what would have been the nation's largest oil by rail terminal in Vancouver, Washington. And we would have had, you know, mile and a half long oil trains regularly coming down the Columbia River. The risks of oil tankers up and down the Columbia River and what that could have meant if an oil spill happened. And it goes on and on. The world's largest frac gas to methanol refinery in early 2021 celebrated an incredible victory after 7 years of working with the most feisty, incredible volunteers, community members in the small town of Kalama, Washington, and climate activists from across the Pacific Northwest. We celebrated this incredible victory of stopping what would have been the world's largest frac gas to methanol refinery. And for folks that aren't familiar with what was proposed, the amount of frac gas that would have been used at that one refinery is on scale with the amount of frac gas used by all industry in Washington state combined. So it was a massive build out of fossil fuel infrastructure. And I think one of the most exciting things that we've seen is this, you know, when these campaigns started, and they've all been these David versus Goliath campaigns, you know, going up against the fossil fuel industry, some of the most slick, you know, corporate attorneys, PR firms in the country. And that sense of how are we possibly going to do this? But as more and more victories have been racked up over the years, the tune has totally changed to, we're going to do this, and this is going to be fun, and we can't wait to plan that victory party. And most recently, to see how that shifted into not only communities coming together to stop proposed fossil fuel terminals and pipelines, but to shut down, to set, you know, set the pathway to shut down existing fossil fuel infrastructure. And most recently in Portland with the Zenith Energy oil by rail facility, you know, that facility with, you know, this incredible decision from the city of Portland, which came after many years of incredible, you know, grassroots community organizing, legal advocacy, to see that play out is, I think, has given people so much, such a deep sense of, again, the power of the people to come together, and especially at a time where, you know, moving climate legislation at the federal level is so challenging.
Well, I was at a demonstration at Zenith on June 4th, the day after the anniversary of the great Mosher oil train explosion. And it's disconcerting to see how much Zenith has built itself up in the last 3 years since they first got on the radar of climate activists and even the city of Portland. And they're still, even though they've had two court decisions to shut them down, they're still plugging ahead. And I'm wondering what Columbia Riverkeeper's plans are to make sure that they actually do get shut down.
Well, we are deep in the trenches of the legal fight to make sure that the, you know, city of Portland's decision stands, and we intend to see it through to the end.
Now, there's at least one other fossil fuel project that's still possibly in the works, and that's out at Port Westward in the Columbia River estuary. And I want to talk first about the latest victory at Port Westward in terms of shutting down fossil fuel, and then talk about the ongoing issues there that still need to be dealt with.
Yeah, for folks that aren't familiar, Port Westward is it's a rural public port. It's owned by Port of Columbia County, and if you zoom up, it's nestled within, again, some of the highest quality salmon habitat in the Columbia River estuary. It's surrounded by millions of dollars of habitat restoration that have poured into trying to recover endangered salmon and steelhead. And it's also surrounded by small farms. It's there's a monastery up on a hillside. There's, you know, local businesses. There are, you know, people that want to live a rural lifestyle. And this port is at a really unique bend in the Columbia River. It's naturally very deep and it's quite narrow. And it was actually developed during World War II as an army depot. It's not a natural site to have a massive industrial port, But there is industrial infrastructure out there, and the Port of Columbia County and Columbia County for many years have eyed this area for industrial expansion and have been very open arms to entertaining proposals from the fossil fuel industry, from coal to frack gas to oil. And for a number of years, the port and county have pushed for doubling the size of Port Westward. So there's roughly 837 acres of surrounding farmland, and it happens to be some of the highest quality farmland that you can come by in the state of Oregon. And they've targeted that farmland for high impact industrial development to tap into the resources of the Columbia River as a shipping and rail transport corridor. What's really remarkable is the scale of this development. And for folks who are familiar with, you know, the Port of Vancouver right across from Portland, you know, that's, you know, the area of industrialized land there is just in the neighborhood of 800 acres. So imagine two Port of Vancouvers along the Columbia, and again, in some of the most important salmon habitat in the Columbia River Basin. So for many years, Columbia River Keeper has been working with community members, farmers, and another wonderful nonprofit, Thousand Friends of Oregon, and the Cragg Law Center to challenge the port and the county's plans to industrialize further this very special spot of the estuary.
And so where's it at now? I mean, we've done a few shows about this already, and I still think this is one issue that most people in the area don't really know much about. It's keeping a lower profile even than the Klamath Methanol Refinery kept for a few years. So how far along is the Port of Columbia County in getting this extension of or expanding the port area?
It's going nowhere, Barbara. They have been trying for many years, and the mechanism they need to use is to rezone this farmland, to have it rezoned using this unique exception in Oregon's, you know, notoriously protective land use laws. And they have attempted to do it now three times. Columbia River Keeper, others have led the fight in challenging those in court. It goes to a special land use court, and we've won every time. And the way Oregon land use law is designed, it really is to, you know, give them another chance. Maybe they can fix it. But the reality is they're not fixing it. They can't fix it. This area is not appropriate for high impact industrial development. And there are many community members who want to see this land continue to stay as a, you know, productive farm resource to the community.
Now, there's one proposal in particular is an issue. There was going to be another methanol refinery that was proposed, and that was the last standing methanol refinery. So let's first of all talk about what happened to that, and then let's talk about the current issue that's still alive.
Right. So we're back to these frack gas to methanol refineries. I mentioned how the world's largest frack gas to methanol refinery was proposed in Klamath, Washington, a company called Northwest Innovation Works. And What we see, and this is played out with different fossil fuel projects along the Columbia, often the developers will pick two sites, three sites. They're just going to see where they can get the furthest along in their efforts. So in the case of frack gas to methanol, they started actually just north in Tacoma, Washington. That failed. Then they put incredible resources into trying to site this frack gas to methanol refinery in Klamath, Washington. Columbia River Keeper and others, we spent many years doing grassroots organizing in court, and ultimately prevailed, and Northwest Innovation Works pulled the plug on that project ultimately after being denied by the state of Washington. But there was still this one outstanding proposal, which is at Port Westward in the Columbia River estuary downstream of Klamath, Washington, near Clatskanie, Oregon. And earlier this spring, Northwest Innovation Works, the Port of Columbia County, officially ended that lease for that proposed methanol refinery. You know, it's pretty stunning at this point if any fossil fuel developer thinks that it's going to be a steamroll kind of a approach to developing fossil fuel infrastructure along the Columbia River. And I think that, well, they could have continued their effort. They saw the writing on the wall that, you know, this was going nowhere.
So there's still another proposal that's for Port Westward with next.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
So the next energy proposal is so-called renewable diesel would be heavily dependent, however, on natural gas, frack gas. And so yet another proposal, this one is that the existing industrial footprint, it's met with a tremendous amount of opposition from community members in terms of the impacts to the surrounding area and whether it can really handle an industrial project of that scale and impact. Most importantly, for many folks, it's really a deep-seated concern about the project backers, their reputation, their experience in other parts of the country, and what it could mean if this terminal does get sited along the Columbia. So that that project is still, definitely in play. There's several, public comment periods that we're in the midst of right now. And our conservation director, Dan Sears, has been leading an incredible organizing effort with community members in the estuary.
Does NEXT need to have this expansion of the industrial area zone rezoning in order for it to go ahead?
It does not.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG up here from KODX LP FM, KMON and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Columbia Riverkeeper's about-to-be new executive director, Lauren Goldberg, about the organization's plans to continue to successfully protect, restore, and care for our Columbia River. So in the last few moments, Lauren, let's talk about, first of all, the shoes that you are going to be filling and the challenges of filling those shoes, and then we'll talk about what you sort of see as the upcoming realities that you're going to be facing.
Well, we've been very fortunate for the last 15 years at Columbia River Keeper to have Brett Vandenhoevel on our staff. Brett has been the executive director for the last 13 years and has been just a highly respected member of the legal community, environmental community in the Pacific Northwest. He has been at the center of these campaigns to protect the Columbia and more broadly other parts of the Northwest from fossil fuel development. He's an incredible legal mind, a gifted organizer, and somebody who we are so excited that he gave us so many incredible years of his life to fighting the good fight with our team at Columbia Riverkeeper. He's been a mentor to so many, including myself, and I'm really excited for his next adventure. He's given so much to our organization, and he's really one of the great climate and clean water champions of our time.
So he's going to be doing independent consulting now? Is that what I understand?
Brett's really, he is such a talented legal mind, policy genius. And so he'll be out there working with nonprofits, tribal governments, and foundations, helping to craft campaigns here in the Northwest and throughout the country to hopefully replicate some of the great success stories that have played out along the Columbia.
Sort of reminds me of what Eric DePlace did, who was with Sightline for a very long time, and now he's still nominally with Sightline, but mainly working with the Ohio River Valley Institute, and again, applying all the wisdom that was gleaned from the years of fighting fossil fuel projects in the Northwest and helping people in West Virginia, Southern Ohio, Western Pennsylvania to figure out how to continue that fight. So I really appreciate when people like Brett and Eric sort of expand the ability to get out the message. What are you seeing as your challenges, and what do you see that the organization is going to be taking on once you become the leader on August 1st?
Well, we're staying the course at Columbia Riverkeeper. We're so deeply committed to the communities, the tribal nations, the campaigns that we've taken on. And we've celebrated, huge successes in the last year and beyond, and including one that we didn't have a chance to talk about. We now have a new Superfund site along the Columbia, and huge credit to tireless work from Yakima Nation. And it's been this great honor for Columbia Riverkeeper to work in solidarity with the tribe for so many years to for folks who aren't familiar, near Bonneville Dam, there's an island called Bradford Island, and the surrounding waters of the Columbia River contain some, fish that have the most toxic levels of pollution of fish caught, anywhere in the country. And it's in one of these, you know, magnificent, as are all places in the Columbia River Gorge. And so many folks that go fishing out there have no idea how toxic and dangerous it is to eat those locally caught resident fish. So for many years, the Yakima Nation has been leading the fight to hold the U.S. government, the Army Corps of Engineers, responsible. That's the who's responsible for dumping the pollution. So, you know, it's campaigns like that that we had this huge success story in March when the Environmental Protection Agency finally listed the new Superfund site along the Columbia. But it will take many years of dedication making sure that that cleanup stays on track, that public health remains a top priority, and that we have really strong engagement from our members of Congress in terms of staying the course on that cleanup. So, you know, across the board, whether it's fighting fossil fuels, you know, cleaning up Hanford, saving salmon, stopping pollution, our organization is deeply invested in this work. I'm so fortunate to work with an incredible team of lawyers, community organizers, communication specialists who, you know, come to work every day with just such a sense of pride and joy and really the privilege of getting to fight for the Columbia River.
I'd like to talk a bit more about your relationship to the tribes, because it's always struck me at every event that I've been to, and one that's coming up soon, the Hanford Journey that's going to be happening in a couple of weeks, that you have such a close partnership with all the Columbia River tribes. So I wanted to sort of find out, how did that get forged and how do you move ahead with that now?
From Columbia River Keepers' inception, it's really been a central value of our organization to work in solidarity with tribal nations, to have strong relationships built on, you know, trust and respect. And when I joined the staff 17 years ago, you know, was really part of a long line of both board members, you know, staff members, that really held that commitment as central in our values and how we move through our work on a daily basis. And so we are really honored as a nonprofit to have built these long-running relationships and to have in the past and currently, you know, we're continuing to work in solidarity with multiple tribal nations campaigns to keep toxic pollution out of the Columbia and, you know, protect and restore healthy, harvestable salmon runs.
How did you build this relationship of trust with the tribes?
Oh, we'll need many more hours to talk about that, Barbara.
You got 4 minutes.
I think that it starts with listening. It's a lot of learning. It's being open to acknowledging error when it happens, and it's showing up in many cases when others weren't willing to. So most recently, one of our newer campaigns in solidarity with the tribal nation, for those who haven't heard of it, there's a proposal to build, it's a pump storage hydroelectric facility along the banks of the Columbia River and the magnificent Columbia Hills near the John Day Dam. And if you look at it, it might just appear an arid landscape, but in fact, it contains 9 sacred cultural sites for multiple tribal nations, irreplaceable sites, as well as an area that's accessed by tribal members exercising treaty reserved rights to collect and gather roots. So this is an example, the Golden Dale Pump Storage Project, where, you know, it is an alleged renewable energy project, and there, you know, many groups might, you know, and individuals might pause and say, well, you know, don't we need green energy now to fight climate change? But we also need to recognize the ongoing commitments that we have to tribal governments, the treaties that we have with tribal governments as, you know, citizens of the United States of America. And ultimately, Columbia River Keeper was the first organization to step out and say, absolutely no, there is no way that this project can happen in this place. And we're going to stand in solidarity with Yakima Nation and other tribal governments that are holding up their hands and opposing this project. So it's really, it's story after story like that, where over time we've built that that trust. And it really, I know I speak not just for myself, but, you know, many of my colleagues past and present, where it really is one of the greatest honors of getting to work at Columbia River Keeper to do this work in solidarity with tribal nations and tribal people.
So what is the status now of that pumped storage station?
Yeah, great question. The Washington Department of Ecology actually just released the draft environmental impact statement. And interestingly, in that environmental review, acknowledged that there is no way to avoid the significant and harmful destruction of those tribal resources. So this is a really important time for the public to weigh in. And in addition, throughout the next probably 10 or 12 months, there's going to be a series of really critical state and federal government decision points where we'll be calling on folks to weigh in and take action. So I would strongly encourage for those listeners who aren't already on Columbia River Keepers email list, go to our website, columbiariverkeeper.org. You can easily sign up for our emails and in addition, follow us on social media, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We're constantly sharing petitions, whether it's, you know, Hanford, Goldendale Pump Storage, fossil fuels, you name it. So much of our success has been because of people clicking a button and being willing to put their name out there. And together throughout the Northwest, you know, when we can turn in tens of thousands of petitions in support of our climate and clean water, it can make a huge difference.
Well, I'm thinking about possible topics that we'll talk about on future Locus Focuses once you are now the executive director of Columbia River Keeper. And one of them is that challenge of how to deal with these supposedly renewable energy projects, whether it's pump storage, whether it's lithium mining, and how do we bring a deeper lens to these issues and find a way to, as you're saying, really respect the tribal concerns because these projects are having a major impact on them. So do you see that as something that you're going to be diving into in the future?
I think it's something we're knee-deep in right now. You know, look at the dams on the Columbia River, renewable energy. And, you know, the reports were clear from the earliest dams going in, the devastating impact it would have on Indigenous people and tribal nations and salmon runs. And so I think we've been maybe neck deep in it would be more accurate. Sometimes it feels like over our heads in that very question. But I think it is a moral question that each of us, as well as, you know, nonprofits, businesses, I love the term you use, this deeper lens. It is long past time to put on that deeper lens and really grapple with how we move forward, tackle climate change, advocate for, you know, renewable energy, but do it in a way that is different than the past.
Well, I'm going to throw out one more issue, which has just recently really gotten on my radar and just is an idea for some future projects for Columbia River Keeper. That is hydrogen, which is Eric DePlace called it the latest new shiny toy. So I wonder if that's something that Columbia River Keeper is starting to think about, looking at some of these proposed hydrogen projects.
Yeah, absolutely. We're taking, you know, part of our MO is to take a hard look at all new proposals along the Columbia Basin and, yeah, leave it up to Eric to come up with the perfect terminology. But yeah, our work remains to, you know, make sure that we are tackling climate change and doing it in a way that, you know, does right by community members. So, absolutely the shiny new object.
Well, Lauren, it's great to talk to you again. And congratulations again on your new position, which starts on August 1st as Executive Director of Columbia River Keeper. And good luck with all the challenges ahead.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful chatting with you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Columbia River Keeper's about-to-be new Executive Director Lauren Goldberg, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBRU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting Community Powered Radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with another Columbia Riverkeeper staff person, Kate Murphy, about the growing momentum to remove the four lower Snake River dams. We'll go out with a tune I wrote. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask when necessary.
Where the river flows, where the river flows.